There are places that people swear are haunted. There are folks on familiar terms with poltergeists, and some who have dreams and premonitions that they swear really do come true. We've all heard of mediums and psychics whose followers claim they have extraordinary powers. So, what's going on? Are these tall tales, frauds, coincidences, hallucinations, or are they evidence of phenomena that is merely unexplained? In the late 19th century, a Harvard University professor of psychology decided that scientists needed to take a look at what was going on. That professor was William James, brother of the novelist Henry James. William is the father of psychological research in America. People still read his textbooks. He risked his considerable reputation to team up with like-minded scientists and writers in the United States and Great Britain to study mediums and their messages. My guest today is Deborah Blum, professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and author of a new biography of William James. It's called Ghost Hunters: William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. She joins us from the studio in Durham, North Carolina, of public radio station WUNC in Chapel Hill. Deborah, great to have you.
It's great to be here.
And if you, good. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And as always, if you want more information about the program, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. So, Deborah, we've known each other for a long time. You are a straight up and down science journalist, former president of the National Association of Science Writers. What the heck got you writing about ghosts?
You know, a lot of people have worried about that, Joe. And I've asked myself also when since I did it, what's a nice science writer like me doing in a psychological, swampy, supernatural soup like this? I got really interested in the idea that there was a time when some of the best scientists in the world were willing to do this. Now it tends to be more fringy than that. But then you had William James. You had two very good European scientists who would go on to win Nobels. You had Oliver Lodge, who was a pioneer in wireless communication, and all of them working at this at the same time. And somehow that idea, if this is the best ghost hunt in the history of science, what did it find, was irresistible to me.
And I mean, why the mid-19th century? Was there something particular that got scientists interested in it then? Because I'm assuming that people had been curious about the supernatural for hundreds, if not thousands, of years before that.
Yeah, ghosts have been floating around just about as long as we've been around. I mean, you find them in every ancient civilization known. I think it was a confluence of things, and one was that you had this incredible sort of period of moral unrest, especially following some of the scientific theories put forth of the time, like Darwin's, which was certainly very upsetting to a lot of people's explanation of the origin of life. And then you had actual major advances of science in the 19th century. I mean, we're talking about wireless communication preceded by the telegraph. There was the telephone. There was, wonderful new advances in medicine. One of the guys that I mentioned before who won the Nobel, Charles Roche, won it for discovering anaphylaxis and other problems in immune response. And so all at once, you had this very credible tool for finding evidence coming together with a real need to find evidence as people's ideas of the world began to change.
We're talking with Deborah Blum, the author of Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. And we'd like to hear from you if you have questions about this. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Deborah, what about this whole question of separating the wheat from the chaff? And by that, I mean there were clearly a lot of frauds who were about just anxious to make a buck, or seemingly just anxious to make a buck. How did people go about determining what was just a trick and what was harder to explain?
I thought the fraud was a lot of fun, and you're right, that it was everywhere. And I love that this was a period in science when, you know, scientists would hide under furniture and leap out of closets, and in dealing with mediums and psychics, used every trick that they could think of, too, to kind of catch the fraud. When they worked, I'm just talking about mediums and psychics because they looked at other things. They looked at telepathy. They looked at crisis apparitions. They looked at hauntings. But when they were working...
Before you talk about mediums, I know it's a funny thing to say, but define your terms. What is a medium and what is a psychic? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, mediums seem to be a very specialized form of psychic. I mean, theoretically, a medium claims to be able to communicate with the dead. Mm-hmm. A psychic doesn't always claim that. A psychic might just be a mind reader, right? Or be able to do certain tricks of the mind, read unopened letters. But a medium specifically claimed to be able to communicate with the dead. And then telepathy was actually a word that was coined by one of the researchers in my group, a philosopher named Fred Myers, because it was called thought transference, and he wanted it to have a newer, techier sound like telephone or telegraph, and so he came up with the word telepathy. But that's the sort of difference between medium and psychic. And they worked with both, but because one of the things they were interested in was, can we prove that we can talk to the dead? Or in James's case, can the science of human behavior study the behavior of the dead and as well as the living? Can psychology do both, right? So if they found a medium that came up with a few kind of what ephemeral, wispy, credible results, they'd start to sort of try to isolate that medium a little bit and make sure that the medium wasn't cheating. I wrote a lot in the book about a very famous medium discovered by William James. Her name was Leonora Piper. And her results were so good on occasions and so inexplicable that people were really troubled by this. How was she getting them? And at one point, they secretly assigned detectives to follow her and her husband for a period of several months, you know, creeping after her every time she went to the grocery store, looking for evidence of her, you know, meeting with detectives or reading gravestones when no one was looking and all of the other things that you might do to get this information. And they never caught her. So then they started working with her much more seriously. They, you know, was her trance a fake? She was a trance medium, you know, and kind of seemed to go into a daze. And they did horrible things to her. Dropped acid in her mouth, stuck needles in her arms, burned her with matches, trying to, you know, jar her out of a fake trance. And actually, during the trance, they could not use any of those painful techniques to get her out. So she was a fascinating case study for them.
Well, let's see what our listeners have to say about all this, because there's things that are very upsetting to some people because they don't seem to be the subject of scientific inquiry, and that makes some people a little crazy. But let's go to Ken in Cleveland, Ohio. Ken, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I love the show. And I was wondering, does the author believe in ghosts or psychics or any of these things?
So we're cutting right to the chase, Deborah. Do you believe in ghosts or psychics after all this
research?
You know,
truth. Yeah, you know, it's the question I was dreading ever since I started working on the book. I believe in possibilities, and I don't mean that as a duck. What I've come to realize as I looked at the way scientists try to get at this, you know, how do I prove this, is that there's not a good scientific methodology that we know for really explaining the kind of experiences people have. And just to give you a really quick good example of that, I was referred earlier to a crisis apparition, which is the name that's given for, say, a relative of yours dies, and the moment that they die, you have a dream or, you know, feel their touch or think you see them or think you hear them. And my father and brother-in-law in California almost 20 years ago had an experience in which he heard his cousin calling him in the middle of the night, woke up my mother-in-law, ended up going out in the yard, hunting for his cousin everywhere, couldn't find him, went back to bed, and then at 10 o'clock in the morning, his cousin's wife called him, and at the time that he was running around in their yard trying to find his cousin had in fact shot himself to death. And that's a classic crisis apparition. And if you wanted to prove that that was more than, you know, too many pickles at bedtime and a lot of coincidence, then what in science allows us to do that, right? How do you recreate that? How do you control that? It's not, you know, it's not predictable. It's not replicable. And so one of the things that got really interesting to me was the difficulty of applying one methodology to reality. And so my long answer to your short question is it made me believe more than I had before that there are perhaps natural events that we call supernatural because we don't know how to get at the natural laws, and that there's a possibility of both human abilities, in particular to receive information, that we don't understand. So I think it was a wonderful experience for me in saying, yeah, this is a big reminder that there are many kinds of reality. We don't get them all.
Ken, just really quickly, because we have to take a break, but did you have a reason for asking that particular question?
Well, because I respect William James quite a bit. I've read some of his work, and I have read on this topic a lot in the past, and I've had some experiences myself, and I would be interested in reading the author's book if you want to repeat it again.
I'm sure I will.
because I think it might be a good read.
Okay. Hey, Ken, I told you we're going to have to take a short break, and so, in fact, that's what we have to do. Thanks very much for the call. We're talking this hour about Deborah Blum's new book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. And we'll be taking a short break, and we'll come right back. Stay with us. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking about some famous scientists' search for scientific evidence of life after death. And we're talking with Deborah Blum. She's the author of Ghost Hunters. That's the new book that explores this topic. And Deborah, in the end, how would you evaluate the nature of the evidence that people gathered, William James and others, for the proof of something that wasn't explained by science that might be talking to the dead?
Some of it I found actually fairly convincing in small pieces, right? What I saw is that they put together some ideas, at least, that I would love to know more about. I thought, for instance, that in their exploration of telepathy, how in the whole realm of how we communicate at subconscious levels was really fascinating. It may even made me think about the way we tell ghost stories in a new way. And I thought some of their ideas and some of what I think of as the very preliminary start they got, I would like to have seen pursued more. What I think they didn't do or didn't manage to do is to convince the mainstream scientific community of that. And so as you follow the story, you see them fighting against a whole lot of scientific opinion that goes the other way and never quite managing to turn that tide. And in some ways, I think that's a lost opportunity.
Yeah. I've talked to some of my colleagues about the book as I was reading it, and they're just absolutely dismissive from the get-go, and they say coincidence. I'm wondering, I mean, there are, 3 billion people on the planet now? I've probably got it wrong, but there's several billion people on the planet now, and, you know, things happen all the time, and maybe what seems mystical and supernatural to us is really just the odds of, you know, the what is possible, what seems impossible can be possible as long as there's a small chance of it happening. In other words, imagining, dreaming about your cousin on the night that he actually kills himself.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, and to me, this is one of the things, if you're going to argue that there might be something there, and my ghost hunter said maybe 5% of everything they looked at had some credibility, no more. So you're looking at 95% that needs to be basically trash canned.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that most of what we call, you know, quote, supernatural occurrences are in that 95%, and that a lot of times when you start thinking about it, there's a really good other explanation. I think coincidence factors into it a lot. You know, I think the time when you find yourself finishing someone else's sentence, is that telepathy, or do you just know that person really well and you know where they're going? I tend to incline toward the logical explanation and the simple explanation. I don't have any problem with that. And most of the things that I looked at didn't persuade me.
Yeah.
But I promise you that if you spend enough time sifting through this really surprisingly meticulous work that was done, there are a few things that, you know, hanging upside down from a trapeze on your head, you just say, I don't see how they got that. And I wish that I could have persuaded a few more, and I did think this, a few more good scientists of the time to say, let's just, you know, surround that like a hive of bees and zone right in and figure it out. Because I do think there are those unanswered possibilities. Maybe we need possibilities, you know. Maybe that part of the allure of all of this is that science makes the world too small for some people, or too limited, and so they hold on to that.
Let's take a call now and go to Bob in Cincinnati. Bob, Cincinnati, Ohio, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What's your question?
Well, not really a question, but something to add to all this. My wife's grandmother was a medium, and she was a medium in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Caroline Chapman.
A professional medium or a private medium?
Well, she had, let's put it this way, Houdini actually came to her because he was always researching this, trying to disprove. And according to my father-in-law, there's no way he could not disprove what she was doing.
Did you ever, did you ever meet this person?
No, I didn't. But my wife did go to a seance that she gave. And in fact, remember Madge of the Palmolive commercials?
Uh-huh. Well, the woman who dipped her hand in the the liquid soap. Yeah.
She
now everybody knows how old I am.
Yeah. Well, she was a client.
I know that too.
Yeah, and my wife said that she went into the trance, and there were voices and whisperings behind her and her mother. And of course, all they could do was hold their hands as tight as they could.
Hmm.
But once again, this is, you know, a woman who is part of their family, who had this gift, I guess, and they couldn't. They were. My wife was still always a little skeptical. But she said, how can I say that she's making all this up? She's my grandmother.
Yeah.
So, and she had done this for many, many, many years.
So, Bob, I mean, what explanation are you comfortable with?
Well, see, that's really tough. Her grandmother has always told her that someday you will believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell my wife, I don't want to be in the same room with you when she comes and presents you with the evidence.
Mm.
But they had some stories. My wife had some stories, like at Christmas, her grandfather, who had passed away before this. But Christmas morning, people were all asleep in different rooms, and there was a knock at everybody's door.
Hmm.
And they got up the next morning, and they said, "Oh, who woke us up?" And her grandmother said, "Oh, that was your grandfather. He was impatient for all of you to get up to enjoy Christmas morning."
Bob, I'm curious to see how Deborah reacts to what you're describing. Hang on a sec.
Well, in part, it's been really fascinating to me because I'm a long time mainstream science writer, and up until I started doing this book, I never heard stories even of the kind that Bob is telling us now. And since I started working on the book, almost on a daily basis, someone tells me some story like this. I mean, it makes a really interesting pattern. But I will tell you, and this is a sticking point for me, to accept that the explanation is I can talk to the dead is a huge leap of faith. I mean, maybe beyond my ability, certainly beyond my abilities at this point. There's parts of it that I'm comfortable with, parts of it that I'm not yet there. And if you looked at William James, he never fully said, he was meticulous about the science. He wanted that absolute proof, you know, that no one could deny that they never quite got, and certainly in terms of scientific methodology. And he came up with alternative explanations that had to do with energy, you know, the ability to pick up on energy memories or energy traces. He used to talk about a cosmic universe. So you see everyone with this fumbling with what's the answer that I'm comfortable with, because to go to, you know, the other day I was chatting with my dead cousin in the attic is really an enormous leap in reality.
Yeah. Let's go now to Mark in Rapid City, South Dakota. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My point I wanted to make is until they form an actual testable hypothesis, which is a set of testable hypotheses, because that's plural.
Right.
Anything they want to try and prove about this is worthless.
Right.
And by testable hypotheses, I mean one that can't be explained away the way psychic phenomena usually is, by saying, oh, there were doubters in the room, or
right,
oh, the vibe was just wrong.
No, I think
the light was wrong.
Mark, you raise a fascinating point, and I know that a lot of the scientists that Deborah researched were obsessed with this same idea. But Deborah, what about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really smart point. It was like, and just to go back to telepathy a minute, there were people in my research group, my ancient, obviously, research group, who would say, well, we've got all this wonderful anecdotal evidence, but what's the method? We don't have a method, right? We have no energy form that we know of that will actually perform this. And in fact, till this day, for all that you hear psychical researchers talking about energy or magnetism, we're not finding that, right? So what the hypothesis then has to be, if you're going to push this, I think, to the logical conclusion, there's another kind of energy that we can't measure yet, a dark energy, to borrow from physicists, or something in the quantum field. If we are ever able to come up with that kind of hard theory and test it, then, you know, you might get some really interesting answers. I don't think we're there. I think we're still in the making, to some extent, the making excuses stage, and to some extent that we do not understand this stage. And I want to say, one of the things I like about this whole discussion is I like the idea that there's many ways to define reality.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and that there's a power struggle over who gets to set the rules of reality. And for me, that's science. Science sets the rules of reality. But do we accept that science, with a very limited methodology, explains everything that it's real? Well, obviously not.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned science, because I was thinking about Science, the journal, back in the day that you're describing. Several of the reports about these mediums and psychics were actually published in Science magazine.
Mm-hmm. And Nature. And
it's beyond my ability to imagine at this point that they would publish anything like this today. So what happened? Why did this fall so thoroughly out of favor?
You know, that's a good question. And as I said, there was this wonderful period, which is, you know, the story of my book, in which you had really good mainstream scientists doing the work with a lot of connection to powerful journals. William Crookes in England published his own Journal of Chemistry, in fact, and published some of his experiments with mediums in it. And so these guys were really taken seriously. And something else, I think, Joe, which is that psychology, for instance, was a really new science. William James, as you mentioned earlier, was one of the founders. They were still trying to define its limits. And so, although science starts moving away from it early on, there was, I think, more hope that it was going to be really easy and that science could solve any problem. And as you get deeper into what we're calling the supernatural here, you start seeing that, as I said, you know, you're not talking about if this is a phenomena, it's not replicable, it's not controllable, we don't know how to do it. Science didn't work for it. And so you had an interesting period where you see mainstream science saying, this just doesn't fit the rules of science, and therefore it's not real. And that was, to me, really the turning point, as science better defined itself, which you really see. It defined all of this, you know, sticky, supernatural, superstitious stuff out.
We're talking with Deborah Blum. She's the author of Ghost Hunters, William James, and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call now, and how about if we go to Matthew in Berkeley, California. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to first begin by saying that I consider myself the classical empiricist. I don't believe anything unless I'm able to touch it. So by making this call, you kind of go out on a limb and you make the statement, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this is anecdotal. I've had everybody's had the ESP experiences where they know the song that's going to come on the radio and something comes on. I've had an out-of-body experience when I was in a coma from a head injury. But what I'd like to talk about now is when I was in school at Northern Arizona University, I was living in one of the older dorm rooms that during World War II was used as to house pilots in the U.S. Army Air Corps when they were doing flight school up in Flagstaff. I woke up in the middle of the night, and something just woke me up, and I looked in the corner of my room, and there standing right in the corner of my room was a ghost. It was an image of a man in a U.S. Army Air Corps uniform. He used to wear the Sam Brown and the cap before they became the Air Force. And he was just standing there looking at me, plain as day. And I closed my eyes, and I said, if you want to stay, you can stay. If you want to go, please go. And when I opened my eyes, he was gone. And you can come with so many different ways to explain that away, but it comes down to a point of, I think, a point of belief, where at one point people said, I believe the world is round, and everybody took them as crazier when you said that I don't believe that the universe revolves around the earth, I think it revolves around the sun, and they took that person and burned him at the stake.
Yeah.
But at some point, you have to say, as an empiricist, if I don't see it, I can't touch it, but I have to at one point say, I believe.
Okay. Matthew, let's hear what Deborah has to say about that.
You know, one of the interesting things that William James said, passing the buck to William James on this, was that people have these experiences on an amazingly common basis, which is certainly my experience since I started working on the book. And those experiences are real. And he made two points. One was, if science doesn't take seriously what people, I'm going to say non-scientists, but what people experience, what matters to them, but what raises questions for them about how to define their world, if science just dismisses that as lunacy, then in the end he worried that people would begin to dismiss science. And then, of course, philosophically, he argued that personal experience and what you see and what you feel has to be fundamental to how we define life. I actually think that we see some of that problem today, and I don't have an answer for it. But I think that people like Matthew have these experiences, would like to have more help than they get in understanding them. And that sense of disaffection, that inability to connect sometimes with science, allows them to say, well, science can't answer my questions anyway.
Yeah.
And we do see, Joe, that rift in society between science and belief, science and faith, science and does this matter in my life? Do I base my decisions on what science is willing to give me, or do I go beyond?
So just very briefly, because we're almost out of time, do you think that science today could get any further in this pursuit of this topic than they did in 100 years ago?
I hope so. I mean, I think we're smarter. We have more tools. I would think it would be really interesting if at some point someone who I thought was a credible scientist sifted through what's out there and said, oh, yeah, let me try to give you an answer.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Deborah.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Deborah Blum is author of the new book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. She's also a professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. When we come back, an update on AIDS vaccines. So stay with us.